very lingering outside. So our final talk today, someone who needs no further introduction, Iván Alvarez. And his title on the schedule is Rigidity and Tolerance for Perturbed Lattices.
Okay, good afternoon. So the announced topic is, I will use the board, but not yet. So the first 15 minutes I will continue the discussion from the morning on, and then and then get to this topic, which they are related. So still something about Poisson matching. So this was an idea studied first by Diefen, Hegstrom, and Holroyd of getting taking this idea of stable matching beyond the case of that was considered before. So we start with Poisson process, but assign each of them some stubs. So this is actually inspired by the configuration model used in the construction of random graphs. So assign each of them some stubs. So we're going to focus on the regular case where each one is assigned the same number of stubs, but this number could actually be random IID. It's very natural. So these stubs are half edges, and they're going to have to be matched up in order to get actual edges. And we want a translation invariant simple graph on the point process such that x has this degree dx. That is the goal. And one way to construct it follows the idea of stable matching. So as I said, we start with dx stubs at each x. Each point x looks at the closest other point with unused stubs that is not yet have an edge to x. So x and y might have three stubs each with only one edge between them. In this case, they don't need to partner again, so they don't consider each other when they look for the closest unmatched stub. So each point x looks at the closest other point with some unused stubs, but which is not yet matched to x by an edge. Okay? And if x, y are looking at each other, then you match them, remove one stub from each, so in other words, you replace, instead of the stubs, you complete an edge, and then and that's it. Now they are matched. So this, and you iterate this, and So here you see this process going on, and this is the process in a piece of R2 with d equals 3. So you get pretty interesting graphs. So the central question is there an infinite component? Is pretty easy if the degrees are high. So if for any dimension, at least 2. If the degrees of every vertex exceed some k, which is dimension dependent, then you have an infinite component. But suppose every vertex has one or two stubs, and one has positive probability, then the answer is no. There will not be an infinite component. So this was in this paper I mentioned, Diefen, Hegstrom, Holroyd, and then somehow the key case, which is still open, is one dimension and degree 2. So every very simple situation, every vertex has 2 stubs, and we match as I described. And here are some pictures of what happens in a large number of points. So we see some long edges, and there's so we believe there is an infinite component. It's kind of an interesting thing of a critical model, because if you reduce the degree from 2 a little bit, then you get a case where we know there are no infinite components. It's a critical model that seems to percolate at criticality. So it's interesting, but it's not proved. Now, but it's in intermediate situation, it's not proved, but in better than just the usual simulation evidence. So, because the usual simulation evidence, the problem with it is you can only examine a finite system and you try to infer something about an infinite system. So here it's one of the cases where one, in an intermediate situation, where we have a problem in the infinite space, we can reduce it rigorously to a finite problem. However, this finite is very large, so the finite problem we cannot resolve because no computers of today or of the future are big enough. So one needs some idea. So let me be a little more specific. So as I said, not rigorously known, but what is known? So we have, this is in a joint work with the, this is Holroyd. So Diefen, Holroyd, and myself. So you see a hint of who prepared the slides. And so we can define an event. It's, you know, it's, the event is a little complicated, so I won't write it down, but the paper is on the archive and published in the Electronic Journal of Probability, so easy to find. So there is a finite event defined in an interval 0, L. So defined in terms of Poisson process in the finite interval, and you can even finitize it more because if you... you can discretize the interval 0, L into some, you know, several hundred thousand pieces, and all you care about is something that happens in these, you know, if the number of points in these pieces exceeds some threshold. So if you have, really, if you have points or not in each piece. So it really reduces to a finite problem. You just have to check some 2 to the 100,000 cases, and you're done. But specifically, so there is an event which depends on interval of length L. So what we prove is that if for any finite L, the probability of AL is bigger than 0.97, then the probability there is an infinite path is 1. So it's done by some renormalization argument. So this is rigorously proved. So if you find any L, now it seems that for very small L, the probability of AL is not that large. So you have to go to somewhat sizable L. But if L is in the thousands, then the probability of AL really exceeds 0.97. And we do have Monte Carlo simulations that examine the event A of 13,000 in detail. So again, Ander has performed these simulations. And in the form of statistical test, we know that we have a confidence of, you know, this confidence, so that the probability is indeed above 0.97. So the real confidence, as we emphasize here, is much lower because, you know, the software could go down, could have a problem, the random number, this is assuming that the numbers are really random, but it's pseudo-random. But of course, these kind of, we also have difficulties. We know that rigorous proofs can have mistakes as well. So so this is, it's still, it's a kind of murky gray area. So it's better than standard simulation evidence because it doesn't satisfy from the finite size problem, but it's still not rigorous. So we have this, and then, so it seems, so if we just take these numbers seriously, the chance, you know, there'll be a lightning strike and this, you know, in Austin in the middle of the summer is still higher than the chance that, you know, this this fails. But that's if we take this these random number generators very seriously, which is not a question. Okay, so let me end this with some open problems. So that I already alluded to, so the non-crossing two-color matching in R2, better bounds for the two-color stable matching. So with the Oded, Schramm, and Robin Pimentel, we had bounds. So this is to consider the most interesting case of this stable matching. Also, the same problem for allocation. So you have blue and red, and you in the plane, and you do the stable matching. So we know this random, for a long time, in fact, before Oded and Robin joined us, when I was working with Ander, we knew that the matching is finite. So we knew this random variable, the matching distance, has tails go to zero. but we didn't have any bounds at all. But then in this paper from 2008, we proved some power law bounds. But we believe the truth is R to the minus 1 here. That's the right power, but we just have this number you see here. And then infinite component for the stable Poisson graph in one dimension with degree 2 can do better than this kind of a hybrid Monte Carlo thing I told you about. So that's the end of this of these slides. But I still on this topic, I want to respond to a question which Hermann asked about the gravitational allocation. So just tell you briefly why that has equal areas, because the stable allocation method is kind of built to have equal area. The process grows and everyone keeps track of their area, and when they have enough area they stop. The gravitational is not like that, so I'm going to skip the general definitions and just tell you that it's interesting that in this area of especially the gravitational allocation, work by Sodin, Nazarov, and Waldberg on zeros of this function was crucial in order for our later understanding of the Poisson case. So although from a probabilist point of view, the zeros of this is a much more complicated process than the Poisson, in terms of the gravity force, this is a much simpler process because the potential, the gravitational potential, turns out to be just log of the absolute value of the analytic function f. So you can work with it. While if you are working with the Poisson process, the gravitational potential is something you have to build by hand as a series and analyze. So it's harder. So it was a crucial thing that people first analyzed this, and this was then the basis for the later work. Now, what is the reason? So here is a quick explanation for why you get equal areas. So again, the process is you have points, and each one applies the gravity force, and that divides space into basins of attraction. So these we call the stars. The centers are now stars, and points in space, they are attracted to a star except for some boundaries. And the force of gravity is exactly Newtonian gravity, so it's 1 over r squared in 3 dimensions, but in general, 1 over distance to the d minus 1 in d dimensions. Okay, and there is some non-trivial thing to show that the force, right, so the force acting on a point is a sum from all the stars. So you have to check that this sum converges. And in fact, it diverges in the plane. That's why you have to work in a three or higher dimensions for this to be well defined. So there is some checking that I'm avoiding, but this is pretty standard that the force is well defined. Then there are some regularity things that I'll skip, but we have these surfaces that separate these domains of attractions. And the fact that the surfaces are piecewise C1 is something that follows from theory of differential equations, and I'm going to skip that. But if n is the outward pointing normal vector at a point x on the boundary, then every point, if I have a point on the boundary, why is it on the boundary? Because it's not attracted to either point. So this means that the force at these points is tangent to this boundary. So it's orthogonal to the normal. Because if the force was pointing inside, well, then this point would be going inside. Okay? So F times the normal is zero. And now you can integrate this. So let's look at the point Z and integrate F times N with respect to the surface measure on the boundary. So we're integrating zero, so we'll get zero. Now we use the Gauss formula in distributional form. So, in a moment. So, what is the divergence of the force? So the force, because it's the force is the gradient of the Newtonian potential, which is harmonic. So, the divergence of the force just comes out to be. Okay, so there is, again, something I'm skipping, but the divergence of the force just comes out to be a constant minus a sum of delta measures at each one of the centers. So, okay, so this just comes from the formula for the gravitational potential. And now you use the divergence theorem. So it tells you that the integral of F times the normal on the boundary, so the force, think of it as the gradient of the potential, force times N, is equal to the integral of the divergence of F on the interior. Now, because the way the basin is defined, it has a unique star inside. So this divergence, when we integrate it there, and we will get twice the volume from this constant, minus 2 pi from a single Dirac that is inside the surface. So you get 0 equals this constant. So the point which responds to Hermann's question is there is no use that of the Poisson process here. So it is based on the delicate thing here is that the gravitational force is well defined, and that when it's well defined, it has this divergence. So this, and then you get the conclusion. So it works for a large class of other processes. Or really, all you need is to ensure that the force is well defined and that the domains of attraction are bounded. Because if they are unbounded, then well, you can't do a surface integral around. Okay, so so in the remaining time, I want to switch gears and tell you about another problem which is related to this. So this is so now I'm going to switch to the board. So maybe we can. Is there a way to? I guess this doesn't matter. So, all right. Okay, and this is the problem of insertion and deletion tolerance. So, the issue of insertion and deletion tolerance really, its importance became understood only after the Burton-Keen paper from 89 or 90, where they showed that is a crucial way to prove uniqueness of the infinite percolation cluster. So that was in the context of lattice percolation models, but the same thing is actually relevant to continuum percolation models. If you are you have a point process and you do a Boolean model around that, so you put disks around the points of the process, but your process is not Poisson, it's now general, you want to ask the same type of question. Suppose that the balls are large enough that you have an infinite cluster, when can you be sure that it's a unique infinite cluster? So that naturally, in this following in the footsteps of Burton-Keen, leads to the question of insertion or deletion, insertion and deletion tolerance. So this notion was kind of implicit for a while, and but studied very explicitly in the paper of Holroyd and Sue in kind of a general setting. But I'm going to look at it in specific cases of interest. So I already mentioned the zeros of this function, which are a translation invariant process. And it turns out this is not insertion or deletion tolerant. In fact, it is the opposite. It is rigid. So this is in joint work with Ghosh, Shubro Ghosh, and what is shown there are two things. So one is relatively easy, and that is the process is not deletion tolerant. And in fact, if you know, you take any finite ball, suppose you see the points of the process outside the ball, then you can reconstruct how many points are inside. So you can't tell where they are, but you can tell how many. And so the fact that you can tell how many is quite easy, and in fact was known to Sodin and Searson, although they didn't write it. It's based on a moment calculation. You can count how many points, the mean and variance of the number of points in a large domain, and smooth the boundaries and infer how many points you have inside. In this case, with Ghosh, we proved there's something harder. We proved, also following ideas of Nazarov, is that there is no further information besides the fact, the number of points inside. So you have, okay, so let me be a little more precise. The number of points inside, and in this case, you know one more thing. You know their center of mass. So if you have, so you can calculate from the points outside how many points you have inside. And if you know there's just one, you know exactly, you can determine exactly where it is. But if you know there are four, you can determine their center of mass, but nothing more. So the distribution is mutually absolutely continuous with the distribution on this hyperplane, which says, well, what specifies the center of mass. Another famous process is the Ginibre process. Again, famous among physicists, should be more famous among us. So the Ginibre process is a determinantal process, but it's obtained very simply. You look at a matrix of Gaussians. So these are independent, complex Gaussian variables. They're not real, and the matrix is not Hermitian. So you look at this n by n matrix of completely IID Gaussians, and you look at the eigenvalues of that. So this is going to be some random points in the plane, and they'll typically be in a disk of radius about root n. But now you take a limit, a weak limit of this as n tends to infinity, and this converges to a translation invariant process, which is determinantal with a known kernel, Ginibre process, very beautiful process. And for this process, we still have this rigidity, but you cannot tell anything about the points except how many. So you don't know the center of mass, just rigidity. So this is again in this work with Ghosh. There are also other series for which we know some insertion tolerance. So if you look at this series, some A and Z to the N, which I studied with Balint Virag, if you look at the unit disk, then this process is invariant under hyperbolic automorphisms of the unit disk. So the zeros of this series, again, A and are IID complex Gaussian. The zeros, again, it's a determinantal process. The zeros are invariant under Möbius transformations. And in this case, we made some explicit calculations, but Holroyd Su showed that the calculations we have imply that the process is insertion and deletion tolerant. So what does that mean? If you have a process, deletion tolerance just means if you fix any finite disk and remove all the points in the disk, then the process you get is absolutely continuous to the original process. And insertion tolerance, you fix any disk and you put a point uniformly in that disk, then the process is insertion tolerance. And one can generalize these definitions. Instead of removing all the points in the disk, you could remove a point according to any rule. And there's, so this process is insertion and deletion tolerant in all cases inside the disk. And it's invariant, again, not translations, but the natural automorphisms, hyperbolic automorphisms. Maybe transformations that preserve the disk. Okay, well, what about processes that don't have any kind of eigenvalues or complex analysis in them? So one natural process is a lattice perturbation. So we start at the lattice, and then we perturb every lattice point by a IID variable. And for simplicity, I'll take the Gaussian case, but we consider the more general case. So what I'm talking about now for the rest of the talk is joint work with Alan Sly. So if you look at this process as I've defined it, it's only invariant to integer translations because I started with the lattice. But if you want to make it invariant to R2 translations, you just make a uniform translation mod 1 in each coordinate. So this is not a big change of the process. So you could do that. But let's just stick to the lattice perturbed by IID Gaussians. So this is a process in R2 which is invariant to integer translations. And here is the question. You take this process, you can consider it in any dimensions. So we perturb specifically by a Gaussian normal, a d-dimensional normal with mean 0 and some variance sigma squared. IID perturbations everywhere. Now, is this process rigid? Is it insertion tolerant, deletion tolerant? That is, if we did this process, but then I did this, and then I tossed a fair coin, and if it fell heads, I went and removed the point that came from the origin. And then I showed you the result. Could you tell if the coin fell heads or tails? Could you tell if I removed this point or not? Okay. Well, in one and two dimensions, it turns out that you can always tell, and just by counting. So you can tell the missing point is missing by counting. So the basic idea which you have to modify is you want to count how many points are in a large disk. But this will have fluctuate too much because of boundary effects. If a point moves across the boundary, that perturbs this count. So the variance, for Poisson, if you have a ball, large ball, the variance is going to be proportional to area or volume. Here, the variance is just smaller, just according to surface area, but that's still going to infinity. But it turns out if you smooth the boundary, so for instance, you could count the points in a ball of radius r, and then average when r goes from some number h to 2h, just average. And if you look at this average count, and now compute the variance, it's not a hard calculation, but I won't do it on the board. Turns out that the variance is bounded now. It doesn't depend on the scale that you looked. So this means that you can kind of detect, not for sure, but you can distinguish the process when one point is removed. Because if you have a variable of bounded variance and you shift it by one, then these distributions are not the same. But it's still not enough to really detect that difference. However, the next thing you observe is that you can do this kind of count at different scales. If you do this at very different scales and count how many points you have and do a suitable averaging over the widely different scales, you can use the independence of the scales to infer, to really distinguish that one point is missing. So So such calculations are done in the paper with Ghosh for these type of things, and explicitly by Holroyd and Su for this lattice translation. And this works in dimension 1 and 2. But then, for a long time I was discussing with Ander what happens in dimension 3 and higher, and we really didn't know until I asked Alan Sly. That's one of the best methods to get a problem solved. And I remember telling him the telling him the problem, said, this is in a new area you haven't worked on, but maybe, you know, we can collaborate on it. And within kind of 3 days, he returned with all the crucial ideas to solve it. So what do you think is the answer? So, say D equals 3 or greater equals 3. Is it, can you tell if a point is removed? Well, so it turns out that there's a phase transition. If sigma is small, then you can tell, and there's some critical sigma. We don't know the value of sigma, but there is a critical sigma. Beyond that sigma, you cannot tell. So the process absolutely continues. So I think it's a nice answer. And we also know that for small sigma, when you can distinguish, you cannot distinguish just by counting. So if you just look at the count the number of points in a ball, smooth it any way you like, that will not distinguish. So you need something more clever than counting. Okay. So let me explain the idea for the proof. So No. So, I'm sorry. So this is ZD. Right. So plus Gaussian. Right. So we have the process, x plus yx. X is in ZD. And yx are IID. D-dimensional 0 sigma squared. Okay, standard Gaussian. Say each coordinate is sigma squared. Okay, so that's the model. Okay, so all right. So what does one do for large sigma? So we want to show that for large sigma that this model with the point removed is absolutely continuous. In fact, it will be Q equivalent to the original model. So the idea is to somehow to map one process to the other. Let gamma be a random oriented path from the origin. So here I'm saying random, and I didn't tell you what the distribution is. So in high dimensions, you can just take this to be uniform. High means here dimension at least 4. In dimension 3, you have to do something more tricky. So in dimension, so let's first think of dimension greater than 4. Then we're going to choose gamma to be a uniform path, uniform oriented path in the lattice. So you start from the origin, you choose one coordinate at random, you increase it, then you choose another coordinate at random, you increase it, and so on. So you have this uniform oriented path. And now you define a new process where So what I'm going to define is a new process, y with superscript gamma, and what it is you're going to, so So if x not in gamma, we don't move the y's. But if x is in gamma, so let's say it's some gamma I, then we replace yx by y gamma Okay, we shift yx by this difference, gamma I plus 1 minus gamma I. So this is some basis vector, and we shift y by this basis vector. Okay, so what we'll get is that now if we look at the process, you know, x plus yx gamma, this is going to be, if you think what is happening here, so all the points off gamma, nothing changes, but all the points, so the origin is now replaced, instead of shifting the origin by Gaussian, we're shifting the origin by the next point in gamma, and so on. So by doing this, what we get is exactly the distribution of the process with the point at the origin removed. Okay? Now, this process is still very different from for any fixed choice of gamma, the process you get is very different from the original process and can be distinguished from it. But it turns out that if you use the randomness of gamma, so this I defined for a fixed gamma, now I think of, I'll define, So you know, y tilde is y gamma, you know, with gamma itself random. So now I look at this process where both y's and gamma are random. And now the claim is that in dimension 4 and higher, this is indistinguishable from the original process. Now, how does one check such a thing? One standard method, when it works, it's easier than all others, is to compute L2 densities. So you have two processes. You want to show one is absolutely into the other. Try to show that the density is in L2. And that's something, a calculation you can do in finite volume. So you take a large box. You look at the Radon-Nikodym derivative of the density of this process to the original process. So let's call Rm is this Radon-Nikodym derivative. For the law of this modified process, I'll call it pi tilde to pi. Pi is the original process. But just in the box. Okay, so in other words, the original lattice points are just taken in the box. And then what we want to show is that the expectation, if we can show that the expectation of Rm squared is uniformly bounded, so independent of m, then we will get absolute continuity in the limit. So that's a standard argument. And now, when you compute the second moment of the Radon-Nikodym derivative, so here I have a lot of measures floating around. So when I do the second moment, I mean with respect to pi, the original process without a point removed, of the second moment of the Radon-Nikodym derivative squared. So then you have to write out this Radon-Nikodym derivative. It has many terms, and you calculate this second moment. What turns out is when you calculate the second moment, it amounts to picking two independent copies of gamma. So gamma and gamma tilde, and looking at the product of both, because we have this averaging over gamma. And in the end, what this comes out to be, it comes out to be expectation of some number rho is bigger than 1, to the number of intersections of gamma and and gamma hat in, well, in the box of radius m. So maybe a, okay, so maybe I'll write gamma m hat. So this is, I take these paths, I truncate them to just the part in the box. I count how many intersections the paths have, and I get this number where this number rho is bigger than 1, but it can be calculated explicitly. And in the Gaussian case, the number rho, okay, so this is bounded by this, the number rho turns out to be e to the minus 1 over sigma squared. E to the minus 1, no minus. So its number is bigger than 1, and this is what it turns out to be when you do this calculation in the Gaussian case. And one can do it in other cases as well, but due to time, I'll just say. So you have this number, and the problem is, when is this number remaining bounded in M? Now, if you have... okay. Now, if you have dimension greater or equal than 4, then the paths have the property, the oriented paths have the property of exponential intersection tails. And this was the first note used in the paper of Cox and Durrett back in the late 80s. So if you pick two random oriented paths, what is the chance that they intersect many times? So if you think about it, in two oriented paths, they can only intersect at the same time because they move at, you know, move at rate 1. So if they intersect at time k, they have the same clock. So intersection of two oriented paths, you can measure by just subtracting them and looking at the resulting random walk, asking if it's returning to 0. Now, when you take two random oriented paths and subtract them, what you get is a random walk, but it's restricted to a hyperplane where the sum of the coordinates is 0. And it spans that hyperplane. So in other words, two oriented random walks will collide infinitely often if the dimension is at most 3, but they will stop colliding if the dimension is at least 4, because it corresponds to transience of a d-1 dimensional mean 0 walk. So in dimension at least 4, these walks will collide only finitely often. And also, the chance they collide k times decays exponentially because it's the chance that the transient walk returns to the origin k times. So this exponential decay for the return probability converts to finite exponential moments. So it means that if this rho is close enough to 1, then this expectation, even if you... this expectation is going to be bounded, even if you take the path to infinity. And so you get the L2 density being controlled, and then you get the absolute continuity in the limit. So this, I mean, I'm skipping calculations, but this is the method. Now, in dimension 3, this method won't work, but for a different purpose, Itai Beniamini, Robin Pimentel, and I constructed a measure with exponential intersection tails back almost 20 years ago now, in the 90s, and a measure exactly with this property that in 3 dimensions it still has exponential intersection tails. So this is a paper called Unpredictable Paths and Percolation, and of probability. And the basic idea is that oriented paths, random oriented paths, are staying too close to the diagonal. They're basically staying within a distance of, you know, if you go distance r along the diagonal, the oriented path stays about distance root r from that. So it doesn't really explore the space well enough, the uniform oriented path. So there is another measure on oriented paths with exponential intersection tails, and that does the job in dimension 3. So here we can just quote that a paper. So in the last 4 minutes, let me just say something about the other direction. So why for small... So this is why for large gamma you get absolute continuity. Why for small gamma we get singularity? In a way, that's the most interesting part. Right, so for small sigma, how you can tell? So And as I emphasized, you cannot do it by counting. So the best way to describe it, in my mind, is by as a kind of game theoretic argument. So let me explain. So in order, so for sigma small, the property we want to use is the fact that, so if you take any path in the lattice, and you sum the Gaussian variables along the path, we know that if you take an individual path and you sum the Gaussian, and the average will go to, well, if you sum the absolute values, the average will go to some small constant, basically order sigma. But now we want to do something more. We don't want to just take an individual path. We want to take the maximum over all possible paths. But they're just an exponential number of paths. So what we want to use is, if you look at the maximum over all paths of length n of 1 over m, the sum over v and gamma m, yv, and we want, okay, we want this to be small, so the limit over m of this to be less than a half. So it's an easy exercise to show that if sigma is small enough, then this will happen. This is just something about first passage percolation, or just really a union bound, because you only have exponentially many paths, and the large deviations are exponentially small. The probability that the average is large is exponentially small. So if you make sigma small enough, you win against the counting function of the path. So this is what we want. And once we have that, how are we proving singularity? So I said we can't do it by counting, but you do it. Suppose that you are a judge in a game between two players, and one player is trying to prove to you that the we all see the process, the points, but we don't know where they came from. Okay? Now one player is trying to prove to you that these points came from the original process, and the other is trying to so Alice is claiming this is the original process, and Bob is claiming that this is the process pi, but without, say, y0. Okay? And you are the judge, and in order to, and you make the following rule. You first go to Alice and say, well, Alice, you claim this is the original process, so please. So, and we see these points. So please show me where is y. So we see the points. Please show me where is y0. So Alice says, well, here is the origin, and this is y0. Okay, let's see. Do we have other colors? Here's a blue. Okay, and then you, the judge, turn to Bob and says, well, you say that y0 is not here, but we see a point here. So this point must come from somewhere else. So you must claim that this point is coming from some other v, and say v1, and that this is just v1 plus yv1. While Alice is claiming that the same point is y0. Okay? Now you turn back to Alice and says, well, Alice, Bob is claiming that this point is the partner of v1. Well, who do you think is its partner? She cannot think it's the same one, because she already said this is y0. So she must point to another point here. And the process continues, right? So she must say this is the partner of v1. So she says this is y1, v1 plus yv1. But then Bob will say, this must be, Bob will say, no, this point is v2 plus yv2. Okay, and this one. So that it comes from v2, and so on. So the process will continue that each time you alternate, and of course, only one of them is telling the truth. The other one is faking it. And what you do is you see who is winning by just adding the length of the edges and seeing. So just at each round, you can declare the current winner is the one where the total length is smaller. And now what we can prove is that if sigma is small enough, then the one who tells the truth will be the winner eventually. And the one who is faking will have to have longer edges. And so that kind of will prove the singularity, because allow you to distinguish the two cases. And there's one tricky thing here, because the faker can, of course, these y's are Gaussian, but they're not bounded. So if I am faking, I can find the point where the Gaussian is very large. However, in order to find that point, I have to go so far that I will lose in this search. So that's the idea. Thanks for your attention. Not that I know, but there should be.
I think in high dimension, we would see the noise which is Gaussian with a given centered with a given variance per dimension, and we see the same as a code book.
But how do you capture this aspect of the deletion tolerance or the rigidity in those terms? So again, let me mention one last curious thing, that if the process I mentioned here in this simple Gaussian case, when it is deletion tolerant, you can remove one point, you can remove any number of points. And when it's singular, then you can detect removal of any number of points. But this is for this class of process, it's not always true. So another thing we have in the paper is an example of a process which is deletion singular to removing one point, but deletion tolerant to removing any two points. Any two. So one trivial example, which is not like that, it is take a Poisson and translate it by a constant. This is a process where you can tell if you removed one point, but you cannot tell if you removed a matched pair. But of course, it's not tolerant to removing of any pair, only matched pairs. But I can tell you what this process is. Start from a lattice, and every lattice point you replace by two Gaussian perturbations of it that are very highly correlated. Okay, so basically it's one Gaussian perturbation which is large, and then a tiny Gaussian perturbation of that. So every lattice point corresponds to these two. And this we can show is deletion singular. If you remove one point, you can tell. But if we remove two points, any two, not just a matched pair, then it's absolutely continuous to the original process. So this notion of tolerance is kind of trickier than one first thinks.
Okay. What about the value?
Our proof gives some bounds. They are far off. Another question we don't know is what happens at the critical sigma. That was your next question.
Okay.
Yes. 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 That's right. I mean, you can tell with probability, 90% after a finite stage, but you can never be sure. But this is about singularity, so this is not about the finite thing. It's about whether they're looking at the whole plane, you can tell. Yes, Gunther?
We might partition the space, three-dimensional space, another way. There is probably also a critical signal there.
I didn't understand. You partition?
So if you partition the space, we are starting this particular grid,
right?
Set D, but we might look at other grids. Okay, we might perturb them, and probably there will be a variable
sigma?
Yes, I mean this is this. If it's a d-dimensional lattice, it will all be the same.
And, do we have some feeling about dependence of sigma on the lattice?
Ooh. No, no. So this is a great question because Misha Sodin asked us also asked this question. We don't know it yet. So obviously there's dependence on the volume of the fundamental domain because you can see some scaling. But suppose you fix the volume, you have two lattices with the same volume. Is the critical sigma the same? I believe not, but we haven't proved it.
Okay. Let's thank Yuval again.
So,